Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do we break the back of Al-Qaeda, reinvent our car industry, and stop the world from being destroyed by global warming all at the same time? I have a modest proposal for you today, my friends. And by the way, greetings, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Wilson Carey McWilliams supplies our quote for the day: a people's memory sets the measure of its political freedom. And speaking of that, in the third hour of our program today, Professor Harvey Kay, a professor of social change and development at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, who I consider to be one of America's best historians, the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, is going to be on. We'll be talking about some of this memory stuff. Alan Jablonski with us in our second hour, talking about what should you do if your house is upside down, navigating the mortgage maze. And Jim Martin's going to drop by, running for United States Senate against Saxby Chambliss down in Georgia. So it's going to be a great day. It's going to be a very great day. But first, this question. What do we do? How do we do this? There's all this talk about, you know, bailing out the auto industry. And, of course, right-wing talk radio is just going out of their way to blame the entire thing on the UAW, which is nonsense. And then, you know, you've got people, you know, kicking around management at GM, Ford, and Chrysler. There's something to be said for that. I would submit to you that management of these companies, and I say this as a guy who grew up in Lansing, Michigan. I don't know if it was most, but many of my friends' fathers worked at the Oldsmobile assembly plant Lansing, and or in businesses associated with it. My dad worked in a tool and die shop that was associated with that industry. And there really was a cleavage, and there, you know, from the days of Henry Ford to today, and you find the management. I mean, one of the senior VPs at GM made the comment. Well, I believe it was GM, might have been Ford, made the comment that global warming was a crock of expletive deleted. So there's long been this cleavage between the Bloomfield Hills Republicans who were running the car companies and the Democrats who were working in them. And I would submit to you that some members of the Michigan congressional delegation over the years have, even Democratic members, and I would put John Dingell, frankly, in this camp, have not always worked in the best interest of the workers because they've been so anxious to fall all over themselves for management, which has been largely Republican and promoting Republican memes. But there's a larger issue here at stake. We are looking at a confluence of events that could be disastrous. First of all, from today's Financial Times, the headline, "Crash in Oil Exploration Puts World on a, quote, Bad Path," end quote. Lack of investment in new sources of oil risks a supply crunch worse than the problems that pushed prices to $147 a barrel this summer. The International Energy Agency warned that cuts and delays in investment that were prompted by the fall in oil prices had put the world on a bad path. So what's happening is that as the price of oil is falling, the oil companies are going, we don't need to drill anymore. We need to stop drilling, in fact, and stop exploring and drive up the price. They go on to note in the article, meeting the demand growth is secondary to the big challenge of compensating for the fast declining production of the world's older fields. Demand currently, last year, was 85 million barrels a day. They're expecting by 2030 it'll be 106 million barrels a day. But the fields experiencing the sharpest declines are where? The North Sea and Alaska. This means the West, the Financial Times concludes, would become less and less of an influence in terms of production, while Persian Gulf countries would become more important. At the same time, as the result of burning all this oil, Ed Crooks in London writing in today's Financial Times, business-as-usual policies would have shocking consequences for the climate, raising average temperatures of up to 6 degrees centigrade. What 6 degrees centigrade increase in worldwide temperatures would do is melt all the ice at the North and South Poles. It means New York City would be underwater. Half of Florida would vanish. This is literally the path we are on right now. And what they say is that the price of emissions in a system that would simply constrain us to 2 degrees Celsius of temperature increase over the next 50 years rather than 6 degrees, not enough necessarily to melt all that ice and cause all that damage, but enough to still make hurricanes and tornadoes worse and all kinds of problems. But to do that, carbon has to be priced at $180 a ton, carbon dioxide. That's just to get us to 450 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. Whereas right now in the EU, carbon is trading in the cap-and-trade markets of Europe. It is not trading at $180 a ton, what it has to be set at in order to provide an incentive to drive production down to that level. Instead, it's trading at $23 a ton. But here's the deal. General Motors is making 100% of, let me restart that. 100% of the cars General Motors is making in Brazil are flex fuel cars. It costs about $100 more to make a flex fuel car than it does to make a gasoline car. $100. And for that $100, you know, less than the cost of the seatbelt system. And for that $100, what you can do then is you can put gasoline in the tank. You can put ethanol in the tank. You can put methanol, which you can make out of coal. China is making methanol out of coal right now. China has coal the way Saudi Arabia has oil. We do as well, by the way. And they're making methanol out of that oil, or out of that coal. And they're making flex fuel vehicles in China. You can mix methanol and gasoline. You can mix methanol, gasoline, and hybrid technology. I mean, just consider. First of all, here's the big frame. We have the capacity. We're producing about 3% of the world's oil, and we might have the capacity to produce 4% of the world's oil. If we were to drill baby drill tomorrow. First of all, do you think that if we drilled all that oil off our coast and in Alaska that's there, if we drilled all of that, would that reduce the price of oil? No. Why? Because 30 years ago, OPEC was producing 30 million barrels a day of oil. Today, OPEC, which has now included two new countries, Ecuador, and I'm forgetting what the other one is. They've added two new countries, which in aggregate equal the production of Norway, the North, you know, substantial oil production. OPEC is only producing 32 million barrels. 30 years later, their production has actually gone down because they've added these two new countries. So what happens if we drill baby drill? Let's say that we increase production by 1% for the world. OPEC will simply reduce their production by 1% to keep prices the same. Drill baby drill is a lie. Newt Gingrich is promoting a lie. It will not save anybody on the cost of gasoline. I mean, let's just lay some of this stuff out, number one. And number two, we consume a quarter of the world's oil, yet we only produce 3%, 3/100ths. Now, what makes this important is oil is a strategic resource. And the reason why is because it has nothing to do with electricity. I had T. Boone Pickens on this show, and he was, you know, we need to get off oil. We need to build windmills to produce electricity. Only 2% of our electricity in this country is made by oil. Now, think about that for a minute. Only 2% of the electricity in the United States is produced from oil. So if we just eliminated all oil-produced electricity, it would be a relatively meaningless improvement in our electricity situation. If we replace those 2% with windmills, it's going to do nothing. The problem is that our entire transportation sector is driven by oil. That's what makes oil strategic. So how do we, number one, save the auto industry? Number two, break the back of Al-Qaeda because they're getting much of their funding from Saudi Arabia and other oil countries. And three, save the climate, save the planet. And four, make strip oil of its strategic value. This is the key to the whole thing. This is the important thing. Oil is a resource worth fighting wars over right now. As Ann Coren points out from the Institute for Global Security and Energy Analysis, salt was once a strategic resource because it was used to preserve meat. And literally wars were fought over salt. Since refrigeration, we don't fight wars over salt anymore because we've got better ways to preserve meat. Oil is only a strategic resource because we use it for transportation. And about 3/4 of all the oil used in the United States is used for cars and trucks. The other 1/4 is used to heat homes, make plastics, make pesticides, insecticides, things like that. If we could take that 3/4 of our oil that we use and stop using it for transportation, that is used for cars and trucks, and stop using it for cars and trucks, it would no longer be a strategic resource. It would break the back of Al-Qaeda. How do we do that? With our auto industry. I'll tell you how.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartmann Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to Teamster.org for more information. 21 minutes past the hour. Okay, let me lay it out really straightforward. First of all, every car that is sold this year will last in the marketplace an average of about 17 years, 16.8 years. And there are about 17 million cars sold every year in the United States. So let's, number one, do as Brazil did. Brazil went from 0% of their cars being flex fuel cars to 2/3 of their cars being flex fuel cars in 3 years. Bang, just like that. I'm sorry, to 70% of their cars being flex fuel cars in 3 years. Simply by saying, hey, it's a law. You're going to sell a car in this country, it's got to be a flex fuel car. Costs an extra $100 in manufacturing. So number one, let's pass a law that says all cars sold in the United States starting, pick some point in time. I mean, January next year would be nice. It's not realistic, but as soon as possible, all cars must be flex fuel cars. Yes, it's going to cost extra $100, just like seatbelts. Keep in mind, that's each car lasting in the marketplace 17 years, 17 million cars a year. This adds up. Once we have flight, and number two, frankly, I think this should be mandated, that all cars will be plug-in hybrids. Because what we have to do is we have to get our transportation sector off gasoline. Now, there's nothing wrong with having it on electricity, and there's nothing wrong with having it on ethanol or methanol. So if you have a plug-in hybrid, a 10-kilowatt battery, a 10-kilowatt-hour battery, which sells right now in China for around $2,500. Here in the United States, they're over $5,000 because there's no demand because we're not making, you know, these plug-in hybrid cars like they are in Japan and China right now. But if we started making them here, we're talking $2,500 for a battery that'll run a car for 20 miles without any electricity at all. Half of all cars in America run less than 20 miles, fewer than 20 miles a day. So with plug-in hybrids, first of all, you immediately start getting, on average, around 100 miles per gallon of gasoline. It doesn't mean they're getting 100 miles per gallon. But for every gallon of gasoline used, with electricity added to it, electricity that can come from windmills and solar panels, for every gallon of gasoline, you get 100 miles on a plug-in hybrid. Make that a flex fuel plug-in hybrid. That is, let's say, 20% gasoline and 80% ethanol or methanol. And now because only 1/5 of that fuel is gasoline, and you're getting 100 miles per gallon of fuel, of liquid fuel in addition to the electricity, you are now getting 500 miles for every gallon of gasoline. Now, granted, we are using, we're putting other sources of fuel into that. Electricity, ethanol, and methanol. As I said, you can make methanol from anything. You can make ethanol. We can make it from corn here. You can make it from sugar cane all over the world. There, now we are getting 500 miles per gallon of gasoline. And the importance of Saudi oil suddenly becomes a whole lot less. Who has been fighting this? The oil industry, their lobbyists, and frankly, the auto industry. And their lobbyists, the Republican management of the auto industry, has been fighting this also. This is pretty straightforward stuff. As Carl Wolfson would say, it's not rocket science, right, Carl? And keep in mind, only 2% of our electricity is generated by oil. So by shifting more electricity into our cars, we're not increasing our consumption of oil. We can put up more windmills. Or we can burn more coal once we've figured out how, and the technology is there. It hasn't been implemented large scale, but it can be, to actually capture the carbon as it's coming out of the smokestacks from the coal. And then figure out something to do with that carbon. And then what we have is a dramatic reduction in our strategic reliance on oil. Oil no longer becomes a strategic commodity. Once oil is no longer a strategic commodity, we're safe. Right? This is how to fix the whole situation for America. It's, you know, this is very, very straightforward stuff. Mandate flex fuel cars, mandate plug-in hybrids. If we're going to bail out the auto companies, say, we will bail you out. We're going to fire most of your board of directors, and we're going to fire much of your senior management that has been in bed with the Republicans and with the oil industry all these years. And this is what you've got to do. We have to be able to transport people in the United States without using gasoline or oil or diesel fuel. Now, Europe is doing this in large scale by having electric trains. China and Japan are doing it with electric trains. Let's build an electric train system, too. Let's get Amtrak off diesel and electrify Amtrak. Let's dramatically expand that. But the whole bottom line here is we need to move our transportation sector and the two-thirds of it that are cars and trucks entirely or largely off gasoline, oil, or diesel fuel. And we can do that. We can reduce. We can get literally 500 miles to a gallon of gasoline or a gallon of diesel fuel by going to flex fuel plug-in hybrid cars. Why don't we do this tomorrow? That's one of the things you have government for. Let's do it tomorrow, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
And calling out my name, yeah. I can't hear you anymore,
George.
I'm walking down the bank, going down this road. I once loved a woman, a child I'm told. I gave her my heart, but she wanted my soul. But don't think twice, it's all right.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I tell you, it is downright strange, very strange. Southern California, San Joaquin Valley, if they simply reduced air pollution, they would save more lives. Air pollution from cars and trucks, particularly trucks, they would save more lives than all the people who die in car crashes. Yep. This is the result of a new federal study. The California Highway Patrol recorded 2,521 vehicular deaths in the San Joaquin Valley and South Coast Air Basin in 2006, compared with 3,800 deaths due to respiratory illness caused by particulate pollution. Findings released as the California Air Resources Board is considering new regulations to reduce diesel truck emissions. Those regulations are estimated by industry to cost $5.5 billion. According to the board staff report, the savings in health care costs would be $68 billion. So industry saves $5 billion by actually, you could flip this around. You say industry is saving $5 billion a year by causing $68 billion a year in illness. But they're not paying that $68 billion, and they're going to fight having to pay the $5 billion to stop the $68 billion worth of expenses. In fact, the study goes on to say if pollution levels were to improve simply to federal standards, the study says residents of the two air basins would suffer 3,860 fewer premature deaths, 3,780 fewer non-fatal heart attacks, would miss 470,000 fewer days of work annually. School children would miss more than 1.2 million fewer days of school, and a savings of $112 million would be realized in caregiver costs for people sickened by this. There also would be 2 million fewer cases of upper respiratory problems. It's incredible when you think about it. Just absolutely incredible. So anyhow, here's the simple solution. Mandate all cars be flex fuel cars immediately. If you're going to bail out the big three, tell them they have to start making cars that are not only flex fuel cars, but are also plug-in hybrids. Jumpstart the plug-in hybrid technology so that those batteries that are selling for $2,500 a piece that'll drive a car for 20 miles without any gasoline or fuel whatsoever, those batteries will come down in price in the U.S. from around $7,000 down to around $2,000, which is where they're selling for in China and in India and Japan, where they're actually making these kind of vehicles and using them. Let's reinvent the American auto industry at the same time we're rebuilding it. And this would then allow us to get 500 miles per gallon of gasoline in our cars. Yes, there are other energy inputs, but not from Saudi Arabia. And thus let us say to the Saudis, sorry, we're not going to send you any more money. Because no matter how much we drill, baby, drill, we only control 3% of the world's oil, and we consume a quarter of the world's oil, two-thirds of that for our transportation sector. Let's get off that merry-go-round. Very straightforward. Ed in Pontiac, Michigan. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. Thanks. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
Got a couple of questions for you. First one is, if we allow the auto companies to fail, do you think there's enough entrepreneurship and drive toward innovation to, so to speak, put Humpty Dumpty back together again?
There would have been in 1980. There's not now. And the reason why is because we have changed our international trade policies, and we have changed the structure of business in the United States to the point, and we've run ourselves so badly in debt. I mean, 26 years, 28 years of Reaganomics now has left this country with an $800 billion, almost $1 trillion a year trade deficit, which means other countries are selling us their stuff. We're giving them cash. They've got to spend dollars, U.S. dollars. They've got to spend those U.S. dollars someplace so they come back into the United States. What would happen if you let the big three go is they would be replaced. They'd be replaced by companies out of China, out of Japan, out of possibly India, and probably out of Germany. Maybe even out of France. Who knows? Right, and the Republicans and all these guys, they'll be cheerleading this, Ed. They'll be saying, oh, this is wonderful. They're creating jobs. Look at this, just like Toyota in Ohio. Yeah, they're making jobs. Well, yeah, they're making jobs, but where's the profit going? It's going back to Japan. And, I thought that having an American industry was all about keeping the profits in America. So, anyway, Chuck in Joliet, Illinois. Hey, Chuck.
How you doing, Tom? Been a listener for 4 years. It's a real pleasure to hear what you got to say on a daily basis, and I wanted to call in and discuss two issues: the GM production of the Volt,
mm-hmm.
and how it relates to what they previously had produced, the EV1, and also too, if we got time, I'll hit home something for you on the flex fuel vehicles. I worked in a fleet, and we used flex fuel vehicles quite extensively in our fleet. But
what was your experience?
Unfortunately, the flex fuel vehicles in the early phases were not very reliable as far as I guess the biggest issues are the fuel burn and then the
ethanol and methanol don't contain as many calories of energy per gallon as gasoline does.
But
they're also a whole lot cheaper. You know, we are taxing ethanol imports into the United States. It's a 54 cent per gallon tariff, on import tariff on ethanol into the United States. Mm-hmm. We do not tax the import of foreign oil. If we tax the import of foreign oil at the exact same rate that we tax the import, 54 cents a gallon, in terms of energy on ethanol from sugarcane, it would be the equivalent of adding a $23 a barrel tax to oil. And you know, it's crazy. Why don't we do that? Well, because of the monopoly in agriculture, three big agriculture companies pushing for those tariffs. If we were, you know, there's over 100 countries in the world, Ed, where sugarcane easily grows, and they could become ethanol suppliers to the world. And you say, well, it takes more gas to make ethanol than you get out of it. Not true in those countries where there's a lot of sunlight. It's, you're converting sunlight into ethanol, not gasoline, like with, you know, corn in the United States, for example. Although corn in the United States isn't absolutely terrible, but, you know, it's not as good. And so you've got 100 countries in the world that are almost all very poor countries that could become developed or developing countries. We could be improving their economies simply by importing ethanol from them, again, with no input from Saudi Arabia. All we have to do is do away with the tariff on ethanol, which is protecting our domestic, frankly, the corn industry, the corn sweetener industry, mm-hmm. which is producing all these weird dislocations. Flex fuel cars in Brazil, 100% of the cars being sold in Brazil right now are flex fuel, and it's working just fine for them down there. I would submit to you that if you were having problems with them, we need to make it, you know, fleet-wide, nationwide, and those problems will get worked out very, very quickly. Yes, you'll burn through more fuel, but the fuel will be cheaper. You know, right now, the cost of ethanol, imported ethanol, if we didn't have that tariff, would be less than $2 a gallon.
True. And your point is very valid. And to follow up, as time has gone on, I was going to add that the reliability of the vehicles has definitely improved.
Yeah.
I definitely see it as a successful short-term solution.
Yeah.
The problem is the offset of our resources of corn and our other products or other agricultural products used to the distillation of ethanol and how it offsets our food costs for meat and everything else.
But see, we can make methanol out of agricultural waste. We can make methanol out of anything that contains carbon, out of any cellulosic material. You can easily make methanol, and you can make methanol out of coal.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you get the question of, okay, how do we recapture that carbon? That's something that we are developing the technologies for right now, because, you know,
right.
converting coal into anything is, again, putting more carbon into the atmosphere that was in the earth. But it can be done. And we should be looking at how to do that rather than how to get more oil from Saudi Arabia or how to drill, frankly, more oil here in the United States. We need to just strip oil of its strategic value.
Well, let me just say this as far as the flex fuel vehicle in itself.
Yeah.
Because I would say technologically the flex fuel vehicle in its perfect element, in its most advanced phase, the most efficient way to actually burn ethanol is to have an engine designed specifically for an E85 mixture. And what that composes is of an engine that has a higher compression that
right.
closer approximates a diesel compression engine.
Yeah.
Because in order to extract the greatest amount of BTU out of the burn, we've got to get our compression values up. But the problem with that is it's not, and then it's not compatible.
Yeah, these are all relatively
gasoline at the pump.
Yeah, so, these are all still relatively subtle changes compared to what's going on in Brazil, where it costs $100 to make a car flex fuel. The manufactured cost is $100.
Yeah, there is not a tremendous amount of additional.
Right. With regard, Chuck, we got to wrap this up. With regard to the Volt and the EV1, you know, originally Chevy was talking about an all-electric vehicle. Now they're talking basically about a plug-in hybrid. I think they need to take it a next step and make it a plug-in hybrid flex-fuel vehicle. And frankly, that just needs to be the standard for the car industry in the United States. Period. We just need to mandate that. I mean, that's the direction that I think that we need to go. Chuck, I gotta move along. I appreciate the call. Sanchez in Montebello, California. Hey, Sanchez, got about a half a minute here before the break.
Okay, I'm so glad that you took that call from Chuck. But I also wanted to stress all you have to do as far as the automobile industry is concerned is watch the documentary "Who Killed the Electric Car."
Yeah,
I'm calling on
this
behalf.
Go ahead.
Well, geez, I wanted you to hear me out because I'm calling on behalf of people who are continually being frustrated. I wish you could hold me because this is important. I need to say this on behalf of my friends and family. We're getting sick and tired of supporting corporate excess, bad behavior, and greed.
I agree. You said it very well, Sanchez, and that's why I say, you know, fire the management of these companies.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Welcome back to the place where progressives come to party, the Tom Hartman radio program, live from coast to coast. And Jim Martin is with us. He is an attorney, executive fellow at Georgia State University Andrew Young School of Policy Studies, former state representative from the 5th District of Georgia. MartinForSenate.com, his website, and he is running in a special runoff election against Saxby Chambliss on December 2nd. Jim Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for letting me be on your show.
Great to have you with us. As a former resident of Georgia, I lived in the North Atlanta suburbs for, I think, 13 years. I had to go add it up on my fingers here, but something close to that. Anyway, I was very familiar with Max Cleland. He was my senator. He was a good guy. Saxby Chambliss smeared and trashed this guy 6 years ago. And I would so love to see his karma come back and bite him in the butt. And you're a good man, and you were a great legislator as a former state representative. And what can we do? I went to your website, MartinForSenate, forsenate.com, about 5 minutes ago, and I'm halfway through right now filling in the form to send you some money.
Well, thank you, Tom. That's I really appreciate that. And obviously, we do need financial resources. The Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee and other special interest groups have been advertising using the same sort of tactics that they used against my good friend Max Cleland in this race. But the interesting thing is the voters realize that the really important issue is the economy. They want somebody to go to Washington that's going to make some sense out of what we're doing to stand up for middle-class Georgians and make sure that whatever we do with the taxpayer dollars is well spent. And they're just not seeing that right now.
Right. And this is could be one of those Senate seats that gets the Senate to a filibuster-proof majority, which is the issue that your opponent, Saxby Chambliss, we're talking with Jim Martin, the website MartinForSenate.com, F-O-R-Senate.com. This is one of the, in fact, it's the main theme that Saxby Chambliss is using, is the boogeyman, you know, look out, you know, Nancy Pelosi is going to have, you know, although she doesn't have anything to do with the Senate,
right.
But she's the face they've put in the ads.
Well, he says that, but it's because he has no platform and no real issue to, he's been a part of this failed economic policy, yeah. Supported President Bush the whole way. This seat was held by Richard Russell, Sam Nunn, and Max Cleland. And those three individuals, have served Georgia well, and they've served it effectively. And so Saxby's not in that tradition. And, you know, surely I will go to work to support the new president. But one of the roles of a senator is to disagree with the president of your own party if you think they're wrong, because you're probably one of the few people in Washington that can effectively do that. Saxby has chosen not to do that the entire time he's been in the United States Senate, never really disagreed with President Bush over any of his failed policies. And in doing that, misserved this state and misserved this country.
Yeah, amen. We're talking with Jim Martin. He is running for the United States Senate against Saxby Chambliss in Georgia. This may sound, you may think, well, you know, it's Georgia. No, this is frankly, I would say a national race. The control of the United States Senate, the ability to overcome a Republican filibuster, hangs basically in these three races. Up in Alaska now, in the recount, it looks like Mark Begich has taken an 814-vote lead over the convicted felon, Ted Stevens, that he's running against. And, you know, a recount is about to begin, or will soon be beginning, in Minnesota in the race of Al Franken against Norm Coleman. Here's your opportunity, my friends. Here's your opportunity to actually participate and make a difference, to help create, You know, we really need a governing majority. The Republicans had a governing majority for a while in the during the Bush administration, and look at the kind of damage they did. Look at the kind of good that we could do. And they're going to fight us every step of the way without more Democratic senators. You need to get over to martinforsenate.com and help out Jim Martin with this. Jim, what other things can our listeners do to help your candidacy?
Well, obviously,
particularly those who live outside of Georgia.
Telling their friends about this race. I mean, this is the, as opposed to the other two races, this is an actual campaign. There's actually going to be an election on December the 2nd, and the goal is to get all the voters to go back to the polls and need to get the folks across the country to help me financially, but also to make sure that everybody gets out to the polls on December 2nd.
Right.
We believe if that happens, we'll win this thing. And, of course, you know, Saxby's going to talks about this Philip Bruce majority, filibuster-proof majority, but the truth is that the new president has set the right tone, is that these problems that this country face, the problems that we face are so enormous that we need to reach across party lines and work together to solve the problems, and Saxby's bound and determined to be an obstacle to that, and that's not going to help us work in a bipartisan way to solve these problems.
Yeah, he's a good friend of Newt Gingrich's, and he's from the Newt Gingrich School of Politics. Newt Gingrich used to be my congressman, by the way.
That's right.
You know, I remember this well.
Is that one of the reasons that you moved?
No, it wasn't. But I lived in Roswell and up in East Cobb County for like I said, 13 years, and I know this area, and these guys have already declared war on Barack Obama. I mean, they're already, particularly on talk radio, but you've got, you know, the Gingriches
right.
and whatnot. So they're all chanting the mantra right now down at the Republican Governor's Conference in Florida.
That's crazy because President-elect Obama did such an extraordinary job on election night of calling this country to work together across party lines to deal with these problems. An extraordinary speech, and it's unfortunate that people look at this as an opportunity for partisan advantage.
Right. So they're counting the vote in Alaska. They're recounting the vote in Minnesota. But here's an actual election.
That's correct.
And if you're a little nostalgic for the days when you could just pop over to Barack Obama's site and give him $25 or your local member of Congress or what, here's your opportunity, my friends. Go to Martin for Senate, MartinForSenate.com, and send some bucks Jim Martin's way. Help out this campaign. This is one of those that will, frankly, I believe, will give us the power and the ability to say to the Republicans, thanks very much, but no thanks. You know,
we're
going to try a new way.
That's right, Tom.
And Jim Martin, what, in your mind, what are the top priorities in 15 seconds that you want to address?
Well, the economy is the top priority, making sure that the taxpayer money is protected and we get this economy growing again. And President-elect Obama has some good ideas about how to do that.
There you go. Jim Martin, the website, martinforsenate.com. Get out there, get over there. Jim Martin, good luck.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. Alan Jablonski up next. What do you do if you're upside down in your mortgage?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do you do if your mortgage is upside down, underwater, basically, you know, owe more than your house is worth? What do you do if you can't make the payments? What do you do if you have an adjustable rate mortgage and you got it because the mortgage broker said, you know, the rate's going to be really low the first 2, 3, 4 years, and then it'll go up, but by that time you'll be able to easily refinance at a low rate again, and now you can't? Alan Jablonski is a consumer rights attorney and a licensed mortgage broker. He's the author of a new book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. His website, mortgage-maze.net, M-A-Z-E.net. Alan, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
So what do people do in the situations that I described?
Well, the first thing they need to do is contact a HUD counseling service in their neighborhood. They can go to www.hud.gov. and look up what counseling services are right in their specific neighborhood and go talk to these folks.
This is the Housing and Urban Development Department, the Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Do they actually run these counseling services, or do they license private corporations to do this?
They're licensed small businesses that basically HUD is paying them to be there for you.
So you don't have to pay for it?
There are no costs. That's a big red flag for folks. If you contact somebody who's advertising on the radio or television that says, we're going to modify your loan, but you call up and they want money up front, you're not talking to a HUD-approved counselor.
Right. So number one, go to HUD.gov, G-O-V, and find a HUD-approved credit counselor in your area. They will not charge you to talk to you.
Absolutely.
And make an appointment and go visit with them. Number two.
The next step is you can go to hopenow.com and speak with them. Although the problem is that the numbers that Hope Now has been putting out over the last year, as far as the people that they've helped, what they're saying they're doing and what they're actually doing, we don't see them meshing right now. People,
who is HopeNow.com?
It was a program set up by the federal government to try to help distressed homeowners.
Those this is dot. Was it? It's dot what?
HopeNow.com.
.com. Okay. Huh. And this was set up by the federal government.
Yes.
Okay.
They've been stating over the last year that they've helped hundreds of thousands of people avoid foreclosure, mm-hmm. but I have yet to talk to anyone that HopeNow.com has actually helped.
So you can try it out, but it may be another heck of a job, Bush administration boondoggle.
Absolutely. With Secretary Paulson's comments yesterday, when they passed the $700 billion bailout bill, many of us knew right away, we knew 30 days ago that none of that money was going to help distressed homeowners.
Yeah, it was pretty predictable, and we're still seeing, all of these companies that are getting all this government money paying huge salaries and compensation to their executives and paying dividends to their stockholders and on it goes. And now Henry Paulson is saying, well, we're not even going to use it to buy up distressed assets. We're going to use it instead to free credit. There is some reality to the fact that consolidated and resold consumer credit, whether it's home mortgages or whether it's credit card credit, is a market that is getting harder and harder for these companies to sell into. The Chinese are less and less interested. The Saudis less and less interested in buying that credit. And so the price on selling them, the premium on selling them is going up. So it's less profitable for the credit card companies and for the mortgage companies. And you can argue it'd be a good thing for the government to somehow make that market a little more liquid. But it seems to me like the best way to make that market more liquid would be to solve the problems on the ground in the United States so that the U.S. consumer is a more creditworthy core asset or core debtor or whatever you would call that, at the core of that debt instrument, that you've got somebody who can actually pay the bill, which has to do with, jobs and decent wages and long-term unemployment insurance and the things that are not that are going to help people not get thrown out of their homes.
Absolutely. Secretary Paulson, 40 days ago when he sold this bill of good to the American people and to Congress, said, we're doing this to restore trust in the system. And he was basically lying at the time. No new facts have come up. He commented, there's new facts that popped up, so we're not going to help out the homeowners here. And he knew what he knew 40 days ago, and nothing's changed. People are still losing their homes. The foreclosure crisis continues to escalate. And, most of us out here are wondering why they're leaving the consumers. They're left on their own and left to their own devices. All of the programs that the banks are coming up with, there's a very narrow window that many people have to fit through to qualify for their programs. Mm-hmm. One of the issues is the stated income loans. When they stated their income, if they said they made $5,000 a month and they really made $4,000 a month, when you go in to modify your loan with your loan servicing company, you have to show, you have to document all your income. So you're actually giving the information to your lender that you may have committed fraud during the original loan process. Now, we who work in consumer rights and in the mortgage business know that 80% of that was done by the mortgage brokers and lenders.
In many cases, the borrowers didn't even know that these numbers were being put on their mortgage applications.
Absolutely. Who reads that stack of two-inch thick stack when the notary sits in front of you and says, sign
right.
here,
sign this, sign
here, sign
right.
here?
Let me just, if I may, Alan, in midstream here, toss this in. We're talking with Alan Jablonski. He's a consumer rights attorney and licensed California mortgage broker. If you have a question and you'd like to ask an actual consumer rights attorney and guy who knows this stuff, give us a call at 866-303-2270. Michael's going to clear the board of all our other calls for this. And you know, we'll continue this for a few minutes. Alan Jablonski's book is called Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze, the website mortgage-maze.net. So anyhow, as you were saying, Alan.
Well, there is one voice of sanity coming out of Washington, and that's FDIC Chair Bears. She has been pushing to try to get the banks and loan servicers to modify these loans and actually forgive principal so that we can cut down on the foreclosure rate.
Hang on just a second, Alan. Okay. Stephanie, Michael is not answering the calls that are coming in on the board. If you could ask him to please grab those. Thank you. I'm sorry, Alan. Continue.
Okay.
And if somebody's calling and it just keeps ringing and ringing, just keep on ringing because we've got a new board, a new call screener, and he's taking a few minutes to get to it. Alan, continue.
She recognizes that we can either help the homeowners today or we can bail out all the banks tomorrow.
Right.
Because the same banks that are refusing to modify people's loans, whether it's an interest rate reduction or forgiveness or a forbearance of some of the principal owed, if they don't do that, many of the banking institutions are going to be owned by the FDIC, just as IndyMac went by the wayside a few months ago.
Yeah, yeah. So what is the potential for somebody if they go into their lender and say, you know, well, yeah, my loan form said that I made $5,000, or even, you know, there are some people who did say that they made $5,000 a month, perhaps with fraudulent intent, when in fact they only made $1,000 a month, thinking that they could buy a house, fix it up, flip it. I mean, we had TV shows called Flip This House, and if the lender would go along with it or even encourage it, they were committing fraud. Is there a possibility of prosecution?
There is that possibility, except that I believe that the FBI is flooded with going after the big fish right now. The problem that these folks are going to face is whether they were aware of the inflated numbers or not, is that they were the ones who signed under penalty of perjury on that loan application that this was their income.
Right.
And what it does is first, that loan servicer could rescind the contract and take the house right away, which they probably won't because there's too many foreclosures out there right now, but it's a possibility. Second, they could turn around and let's say that the homeowner lost their job and they need to go into bankruptcy court. You could lose your bankruptcy protection under Chapter 7 or 13 if fraud can be shown.
Ouch. We're talking with Alan Jablonski, his website, mortgage-maze.net, a consumer rights attorney and licensed mortgage broker, author of the new book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. We'll take your calls for Alan right after this break. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. TomHartman.com for our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for a free video stream.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Viagra for your brain. Alan Jablonski is with us. He is a consumer rights attorney and licensed mortgage broker, the author of the new book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. His website, mortgage-maze.net. And, Alan, you want to take some calls?
Surely.
Okay, Ezekiel in Upton, California. You're on the air with Alan Jablonski.
Hello, is that me?
That's you.
Oh, good. Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot. This is for Mr. Jablonski. I bought a home in 2006. It was for $385,000. It's been reappraised now at like $245,000. And I went into my lender.
We just lost him, yeah. So what do you, you know, as much as we knew of that, what do you do if you go into your lender and they say, you know, well, whatever. I mean, what do you do if you've got a $300,000 mortgage on a house that's worth $250,000?
Well, it depends on what your financial situation is. I could never counsel anyone who can afford their current mortgage payments to walk away from the contract. You would be as irresponsible as the people on Wall Street and the lenders and brokers that got you into that loan in the first place. If you're facing...
Well, what's the, setting aside the issue of responsibility, of morality, what is the consequence of walking away from a mortgage?
Basically what they could do is they can turn around and sell your home, whether it through a real estate agent or at auction, and you can be liable for the loss, the difference between what was owed and what that house sold for. Although there, as long as no fraud was committed during the process, you would be bankruptcy would be available to you.
Right.
As a protection.
Otherwise, it's a lifetime of bill collectors. James in Phoenix, you're on the air with Alan Jablonski. Hey, James.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Good.
Very good. I had a quick question. I am not knowing what to do. My question is, me and my neighbor both buy a home at $300,000. Now, a year and a half later, these houses are worth $200,000. Now, my neighbor has kind of stopped paying payments because he can't afford it, and his house is going into foreclosure. Now, if he's able to renegotiate his loan with the bank and, you know, maybe get his principal down to $200,000 and renegotiate with the bank, and I'm, on the other hand, struggling but still being able to pay my payments, is there anything I can do rather than kind of, you know, go into foreclosure as to being able to speak to this bank?
Well, is your loan a fixed loan? Are you in a 30-year fixed?
I'm not. I'm in a 5/1 ARM.
Okay, then it's going to adjust out. It's going to go adjustable in the next couple of years.
Yes.
Then I would start talking to your bank now and try to renegotiate and do a 30-year fixed right now. And during that process. Argue with them that they should reduce your principal a little bit to assist you so that you can stay in your home. You have to let them know that there's a problem. This is the difficulty that most homeowners are facing, that with all the assistance that the banks claim that they're putting out there, you must fit into a very narrow window of being able to afford the house or whatever the renegotiated principal is and the payment rate. And then also being in distress right now. Most of them want you to be behind on your mortgage payments, which is a little late to start talking about a solution. They should be talking to people about getting a reasonable solution now before the problem goes into foreclosure, you know, 6 months.
So should James start going late on his mortgage payments in order to get the attention of his bank?
It's sad, but many of them are requiring that.
Yeah.
I would press them. Tell them that you're not going to be able to afford the payment once it adjusts. You want to address the problem right now. And I'll tell you what I've heard from a couple of my clients that we've spoke to in the past. Get the CEO's name and number of whatever bank it is. Send them a letter. Tell them if you're not getting any help with the people that you're talking to at the customer service level, and many people are getting the runaround, also go to a HUD counselor and talk to them. Tell them of your situation. They're not going to charge you to sit down and talk with them.
And yeah.
Then start approaching your bank and
right.
Work your way up.
Would everything apply the same way if, because when I got my loan, I got actually an 80-20 loan, so I do have two different loans, so would it apply the same way? I would just need to talk to both of these companies?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, great. Okay. James, we got to move along here. Doris in Columbia, South Carolina. Quick question, Doris.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering, while I was in here listening, what do you think the intention was originally of these lenders, knowing that these APR loans weren't going to be made? Do you think they wanted to get some of these houses so that they can make a profit, knowing that the consumer wasn't going to be able to afford it? Do you think that
Absolutely.
Was all?
No, I don't believe that was the reason. The reason for this is just pure greed. They wanted to show great profits over the last few years. I don't think even the banking industry understood the ramifications of this problem. We haven't seen the worst of it yet. These option arm loans are going to continue to recast over the next 3 to 4 years.
All right. Alan, can you stick around for another 10, 15 minutes, take a few more calls?
Sure can.
Great. We're talking with Alan Jablonski. His website, mortgage-maze.net, his book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze, taking your calls at 866-303-2270. It's 27 minutes past the hour. TomHartmann.com for our live chat room. AirAmerica.com for our free video stream. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call
866-303-2270. I don't think I'd want your job. I can barely handle the simple one I got. And hey, Mr. President, how cool is Air Force One? Are those guys in the House and the Senate ever gonna get anything done? I ain't no Democrat, ain't no Republican. We're fathers and mothers, we're wives and husbands, and we pray that we dance at our daughters' weddings and our sons grow to fine men and for peace on our land. Hey, Mr. President.
Talk radio for the sane among us. An increasing majority. It's nice to know. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. 35 minutes past the hour. We're talking with attorney Alan Jablonski, mortgage-maze.net, his website, his book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. Alan, you still with us?
Sure am.
Okay, let's take some calls here. And to the callers, try to be short and punctual with your questions, and Alan will be short and punctual with his answers because we've got a whole board slam full of calls here. Linda in Hollywood, Florida, you're on with Alan Jablonski.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Your question?
Good. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've been in my house since 94 and through a series of refinancing for various reasons. Wound up with a very high payment and just I've always paid, but in the last 3 months have been unable to. I've been talking with the mortgage company. Last week I called them and tried to make one payment. They told me they couldn't accept the one. They needed two, which I couldn't do at the time. And I want to stay in my house. The value of the house has gone down over $100,000 in the last year. I would like to just know what I could possibly do.
The first thing you should do is contact a HUD counselor. Go to HUD.gov and find a counselor in your neighborhood. It's very difficult for an individual to try to renegotiate their loans with their lender without some assistance. Now, what I also suggest, and people have to be very careful about this, as a mortgage broker, I've seen all the emails going around in the mortgage brokerage area. The mortgage brokers are trying to get in on the loan modification business. So the very people who helped create the problem are now stepping in saying they can help you. They have no fiduciary duty to their clients. So if you can't get help through HUD or Hope Now, then the next step is to talk to an attorney in your area who may be able to help.
to help Linda?
Thank you for that, because I was contacted actually by a company who did this recent appraisal, and I've been calling them now the last week, and, you know, I haven't been getting a call back, and they were the ones who told me that I need to be current on my mortgage in order for them to work any kind of deal.
Don't trust any company that calls you. We're getting all kinds of emails from people saying, hey, I got a call from this company. They're claiming they can help me. Initiate the phone call with a HUD-approved counselor or an attorney, period.
Right. If they're trying to sell you services, forget it. Gray in Alma, Georgia. Hey, Gray, you're on with Alan Jablonski.
Yes, sir, Mr. Jablonski. I've got a problem with my mortgage. I have recently tried to figure out a way to make my payment, and it's in the process of going before public auction for foreclosure. Is there any way to salvage any kind of relationship to fix my problem?
When's your auction going to take place?
It's supposed to go in the 1st of December.
You need to get on the phone with your bank right now. This morning, this afternoon, you need to go down, find a HUD-approved counselor, go on the Internet. You'll see a little counseling services. Click on that button there, put in your city and state, and find a counselor and get down there today. It may or may not be too late for you, sir.
Okay, good luck, okay. Ray, on that. Good luck. Tom in Seattle. Hey, Tom, you're on with Alan Jablonski.
Hey, Alex. I'm calling. There are a lot of people that are already in bankruptcy, and I noticed that these new bailout procedures exempt people that are in Chapter 13 bankruptcy already, and those people are just really getting the shaft on this because they can't even participate, and they did the Chapter 13 bankruptcy just to protect their home anyway. Is there anything happening on that realm for people that are already in Chapter 13 bankruptcy?
There is no law that has been passed this year, no federal law that's been passed this year that does anything to protect homeowners. The Foreclosure Prevention Act, the Stimulus Act, the bailout, all of them have the same language that has been enacted through the Truth in Lending Act, et cetera.
It's all about protecting bankers and not bankees.
The government has been protecting the financial institutions over the last year and not the homeowners.
Right.
So
another call to make might be to your state representative, your federal representative, your U.S. member of the House of Representatives, or your two U.S. senators to say, you know, I got this problem. I want you to do something about it. I realize you can't help me personally, but you can introduce legislation that will help all of us.
Absolutely. And I have suggested this to people in the past. Call your state assemblyman. Call your state senator. Call your congressman or congresswoman, your state senator. Tell them, you know, you've been hearing about all that they've been doing for you. I want you to help me with my bank and see, you know, most offices have liaisons that deal with problems for their constituents.
Right. So sometimes maybe even they'll contact the bank. That's an interesting one. Alan Jablonski is with us. Dan in Phoenix, you're on the air with Alan.
Yeah, hi. I have a similar problem as James, which was your first caller. Almost verbatim, the financial situation. However, my situation is aggravated by two specific things. One of which is we bought our home from a new home builder who stuck us in a crappy mortgage in lieu for, you know, getting some upgrades, and we refinanced out of that mortgage in January of 2007 into a 5/1 ARM interest only. Since then, our values declined about 30%. I'm very well aware of where it is because I'm in the industry, and that's one problem that I've heard people having is not being able to work with the banks because they refinanced their mortgage. Well, we didn't pull any cash out. We did an 80-20, and you know, basically, you know, we afford our mortgage currently. It's tough, but, you know, at this point, I mean, you know, because I'm in the industry, my income's gone down substantially, so has my wife's. and we're wondering what that problem, what I can do about that problem. And secondly, we also own investment property, which fortunately are doing okay, but we're also learning that you have to qualify for the payments of the investment properties without the income.
Hmm.
It is, you know, you're facing an uphill battle. It's much easier for people who had their purchase money mortgages didn't refinance, that can talk with their lenders. Although I've got to tell you, across the board, the lenders are not doing what they're telling the public they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one out there that is watching the numbers. You know, you have Citibank come out and say, well, we've got this new program. Well, I want to see the numbers. I want to hear who they're helping.
Yeah.
And I'd like somebody to email me that they got their principal reduced through some kind of modification or workout. They can send me an email at alan@ajconsumerwatch.com. I want to hear what I have yet to hear. One person who got a principal reduction.
Well, we had a VP of Citibank on either yesterday or the day before, and that was the day that they rolled this thing out. So maybe it's just beginning, or maybe they're just blowing smoke at us.
Bank of America and Chase have all talked about programs over the last couple of months that they were on board with helping people. And I have yet to hear anything about a principal reduction.
Okay. So we need the power of government to come down on these guys' heads hard. Dan, thank you for the call. Steve in Discovery Bay, California. You're on with Alan Jablonski.
Thanks for taking my call. Discovery Bay is about 10 miles from Mountain House, which you mentioned the other day.
It's a community where 90% of the houses are upside down.
That's correct. And the cancer has obviously spread to the neighboring communities, including my own. I bought my house for $380,000 6 years ago. A comparable house around the corner was bank-owned for a year and boarded up and sold last month for $200,000. There's a boarded-up house on every block of our neighborhood, and people are walking away. There's foreclosure buyers, you know, people burning their houses down to try to get insurance money, which is, you know, criminal and horrible, but it's happening.
Steve, we have 30 seconds. You have a question for
Dude, the math. I've done the math. No, there's almost no way to benefit by continuing paying this mortgage. People are renting houses for $1,000 a month, but should I walk away? That's what I'm wondering.
Well, I could never counsel anybody to, on an individual basis, to be act like these gentlemen on Wall Street have acted over the last few years. But I can't deny the economic sense. If I was $300,000 upside down in my house, would it make economic sense to walk away? Yeah, probably.
Alan, in the next segment, we're going to bring on an advertiser for a very short 2-minute segment to talk about their success advertising. And if you can stick around, we can pick up a couple more calls after that.
Surely.
Great. Alan Jablonski, his website, mortgage-maze.net, his new book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. Stick around.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at hartmanradio.com.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting your show, supporting our show, your radio station, and our advertisers. Let them know you're listening. And speaking of our advertisers, Steve Hsu is with us. He is the Marketing Communications Director of Independent Power Systems, We regularly put on our advertisers for a very short two-minute segment, 1 minute to talk about their product, give them a chance to pitch their product, and a tip of the hat to them and thank them for advertising on our local affiliates. Steve is advertising on KKZN in Denver. And also to talk about the success, and a second minute to talk about the success they're having with advertising and progressive talk radio. And then we'll be getting back to Alan Jablonski. Steve, welcome to the show.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. The website is Solar IPS, Independent Power Systems, solarips.com. Great website, by the way, Steve. Looks
Thank
like Independent Power Systems is doing great stuff there in Colorado. You want to tell us about it? Tell us about what you're doing, what your product is.
Well, Tom, in Colorado, we primarily do solar PV, which is photovoltaic systems. In Montana, where we also operate a branch, we do a lot more off-grid, so we combine wind and not off-grid solar. So in Colorado, we mainly do what's called grid-tied solar. So we put solar panels on your roof, and they connect to the power grid through a thing called an inverter. So the power that's made on your roof is actually converted from converted to power that's usable by the grid by a piece of equipment called an inverter, and it has a thing called a net meter. So when you produce power, your meter actually spins backwards. So that's something that's really neat about solar electric. This is all made possible by something called Amendment 37, which is a people-powered initiative to change the Colorado Constitution to create a renewable energy portfolio for the state. And that mandates that Colorado will produce 20% of their energy through wind and solar power by 2020. So to go along with that, the investor-owned utilities here in Colorado have quite a substantial rebate of $350 a watt for solar systems. And that combined with the federal tax credit, which is uncapped, of 30%, that can wind up being about 60% of the total cost of a solar electric system.
So, wow, that's great. We're talking with Steve Hsu. He's the marketing communications director for Independent Power Systems in Colorado and Montana, solarips.com. Steve, how's your results been advertising on KKZN in Denver?
Tom, the results have been amazing. I was so surprised. Our great account executive, Tanya Gates, told us that we might have to wait a while to get some results, but the phone started ringing almost immediately, and I'd say we're getting 5 to 10 calls a week since we started advertising with KKZN. So it's really awesome to be able to really target our audience. I mean, I know that people who are listening to KKZN are educated and interested in change and, you know, they're the perfect audience for our message and for our product. So it's been really amazing.
That's great. Steve, thanks so much for advertising and Progressive Talk Radio and for being with us today and for the great work you're doing, solarips.com. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Great talking with you. Alan Jablonski is back with us. And Alan, in fact, I'm gonna nail Alan down on the other side. Alan, you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Amy in San Diego, California has a question for you, Alan. Amy, you're on the air. Amy in San Diego? On the left side of the board? Nope. Not hearing anything from Amy. Let's see here. Ezekiel in Upland, California. Hey, Ezekiel.
Hi, Tom. Sorry we got disconnected. I think I'm over the Bermuda Triangle. Anyway,
okay. So what's up?
The bottom line was is that I had 100% financing, 30-year fixed, and I'm upside down on my mortgage. I went to my lender, and they basically said, why would we renegotiate anything with you? You're up on your payments, even though now you're struggling with costs and services of other items, you know, increasing. And you're not facing foreclosure. And it just occurs to me that, gee, I should have bought a $3 million home and then got into arrears, and they would work with me. And you guys just weigh in on that. What do you think?
Sure.
Well, if you got a 30-year fixed and you proved your income and you've been making your payments – odds are your lender is not going to work with you because all that could be done is lower the principal owed or lower your interest rate. I think that what a lot of people and what this caller is frustrated about is, why is everybody else getting helped that got themselves underwater and are being foreclosed on, where I've been responsible, I'm making my payments, and everybody else is getting help? I want to let this caller know everybody else is not getting help. The foreclosures are going through the roof. It is increasing exponentially over and will continue to do so into next year. If you're making your payments and you're happy with your home, stay with it. Whether I can't counsel people enough that your home is your home.
And the values will eventually come back.
stop looking at it as an investment tool, and look at it as your home.
Yeah.
Now, if you get into a situation where you can't afford your payments, then start talking to your lender.
And that's a whole different thing. And then, you need to, like all these corporations coming to us with their hand out, you need to be too big to fail. Mike in Florida, you're on with Alan Jablonski.
Guys, I tell you, I've got a $20,000 balloon that's going to come due in a year. Everything is current. Unfortunately, I'm upside down. What was selling for $280,000 a year ago just sold one in foreclosure for $85,000. You know, in a year, I'm not going to be able to handle that $20,000 balloon with no equity.
Is your credit good right now?
Actually, my credit just changed. I couldn't believe it. It went from 644 to 559 in 1 month with no changes in my credit account.
Okay, well, there must be something. You can go to annualcreditreport.com and get all three of your credit reports for free. You're allowed to do that once per year. Take a look and see the negative. You've got to have negative information to be in the 500.
I would have agreed, Alan, but, I mean, I just got a report. I have a monitoring service.
Okay.
I just got a report that said no changes.
Okay, well, you need to check it yourself. Basically, if with that situation, go to a HUD counselor. Start talking to them now. Don't wait until next year.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Mike, for the call. Yeah, that seems to be the bottom line. Is you can go to HUD.gov, Housing and Urban Development, HUD.gov, and check it out. And, of course, Alan Jablonski's book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze, mortgage-maze.net. Thank you, Alan.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
If you want to know about the history of this country, which I would submit to you is a useful bit of knowledge to have. What the founders really had in mind, how they envisioned this country, what were the debates of the time, what was life like, what was the founding of America? The best history book is Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Without exception. I've said this for several years on this program. It was my book of the month on BuzzFlash. When it first came out, what was that, about 3 years ago, Harvey K? Harvey K? Hey, Harvey! Are you with us?
Yeah, there was an echo on the line, Tom.
Oh,
great,
okay.
But it's great to hear your voice.
Oh, okay. You can hear me now?
Yeah, as I say, it's a bit unclear, but I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Great. This is just an absolutely spectacular book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. You write also for TomPaine.com and The Guardian. We're talking with Harvey Kay, the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. He is also the professor of social change and development at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and working on a new book on FDR, The Greatest Generation and the Four Freedoms. And Harvey, three things broadly I wanted to talk with you about today. The first, just to finish up on my rant of yesterday, I opened the show with this. It makes me crazy when I hear people, particularly Republicans, go off on these riffs about FDR's New Deal didn't do anything. The New Deal was a waste of time. You know, Rush Limbaugh, for example.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
They go so far as to say that FDR's New Deal actually prolonged the Great Depression, and therefore the only thing that saved us from the Great Depression was World War II. And I have suggested that, in fact, World War II in the long term probably did more harm to us than good because we took so much of our productive capacity, turned it into bombs, and dropped it on Germany and Japan. Your thoughts on all this?
Well, first of all, we should take it as a good sign that conservatives and right-wingers like Rush Limbaugh are attacking FDR. That shows just how worried they are about the opportunities that exist right now for progressive change. Okay, they're worried about a New Deal once again. Now, on the question of the Second World War, you know, it depends on how you look at it. I mean, who would support the idea of war as a way of increasing productivity? But it's also the case that in the course of that war, there were not only did we fight fascism overseas, but the labor movement grew even larger. The NAACP grew. African Americans basically compelled Roosevelt to open up defense industries to black workers. No war is welcome. I can imagine a hell of a lot better way to accomplish the.
In other words, because of World War II, because World War II sucked up so much of the labor force, it drove up the cost of labor, it drove down the availability of labor. This provided an opening for the labor unions to get stronger. They're getting stronger. Then the consequence of that was that led to the economic explosion of the 1950s through the 1980s. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean it is, but I mean I think
so. To say that the economic stimulus of the war is what got us out would be really putting the cart before the horse.
The 1930s New Deal definitely saw economic recovery, but not to the extent we would all have wished for. And I'm not that old, obviously, but not to the extent that Americans would have wished for, because unemployment remained high.
Right.
But let's make it clear. I mean, in the 1930s, we saw the introduction of Social Security. There was the Wagner Act, which enabled workers to organize and have the federal government guarantee that right. We saw the advances in the transformation of the American countryside and the refurbishment of the nation's infrastructure. I mean, it's probably the case that what really makes the 1930s and the early 1940s important is far more than the question of whether or not capitalism was saved, and far more the fact that under Roosevelt's administration, with the mobilization of American working people, we saw the advancement of freedom, equality, and democracy on an unprecedented scale.
Mm, very well said. You recently wrote a piece. The headline, as I recall, was "This Election Has Not Realigned the Country."
Right, that was a little note I sent around to friends and family.
Yeah, and your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it is the case that no election in itself, especially the first time out for a candidate, represents a realignment. The real question now is whether or not Obama, based on the kind of coalition that seems possible, is able to pursue a first-term administration that will make that potential coalition into a real coalition. In other words, will Obama pursue such things as national health care effectively? Will Obama pursue the Employee Free Choice Act? Will Obama pursue an energy policy that enables both enables us to address the energy question and also economically recover the economy? So when you come down to it, the question is, will Obama pursue an administration that makes the coalition truly viable and truly effective?
And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that if we're going to wait on any president, we're in trouble. That the only way a president succeeds in a progressive direction is if we, the American people, we working people, get better organized and make sure that we keep them honest. In other words, progressivism is not merely the making of those who sit at the top. It's a consequence of those of us who sit beneath them pushing them in a progressive direction. That's what happened in the 1930s, and that's what we need to do now as 2010 approaches.
We're talking with Professor Harvey Kay, professor of social change and development at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, author of numerous books, including Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Harvey, your website. I'm sorry, I'm missing that.
The website, well, they can either go to the UWGB, where I'm on the history pages or on the social change development pages. I don't have my own website. I'm behind the times.
Oh, you need to get on that, Harvey. People can Google you, too. It's K-A-Y-E, Harvey K. And of course, your books are online, and if it's not in your local bookstore, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, demand that they get one for you and three more copies to put on the shelves. Harvey, when I read Thomas Paine's Rights of Man, which Paine wrote in large part in rebuttal to the arguments that he had with Sir Edmund Burke, the British conservative who famously said words to the effect of, "It does me no harm if a man is allowed to pursue a profession as servile as candlemaker, tallowmaker, or hairdresser, but it does society considerable violence if such a man is allowed to participate in governance," in other words, vote.
That was very good memory you've got.
Thank you. Thank you, because I just did that from memory. It's probably pretty badly paraphrased, but nonetheless, that was Edmund Burke. That was the prevailing conservative wisdom of the day, and it is today as well, as the Republican Party goes from state to state trying to cut down the number of people who can vote legally. Essentially, nothing has changed. But when you read The Rights of Man by Thomas Paine, the guy that you wrote this book about, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, He was proposing, if my recollection is correct, and it's been a half a decade since I read it, essentially Social Security, minimum wage, I mean, just a whole breadth.
Absolutely.
Give us the overview of how the founders, many of the founders, including Thomas Paine, really saw the potential of this nation.
Yeah, and in fact, it's interesting to consider this, that however much behind we may seem in social democratic terms, in the sort of making of national health care and all the things that make for a better life, it is the case that it was American visionaries who proposed those very things. Okay, and the idea for us, of course, is to kind of redeem that American vision and realize them in the present day. You know, you made an interesting point about conservatives' reservations about democracy, to put it mildly. When I was on television a few years ago being interviewed by the conservative intellectual Michael Novak, he was trying to really criticize Paine as being merely a rabble-rouser and having far too much confidence in the people. And what became very obvious to me is that the conservatives just don't trust the American people. And if we progressives are going to make progress, then we have to remind ourselves that that democracy demands that kind of trust in our fellow citizens.
Well, they never have. I mean, the conservative movement goes back to Thomas Hobbes and Leviathan, suggesting that the essential nature of humans is evil and will produce, you know, a poor, nasty, and brutish society without the iron fist of church or state.
Right. And you can see that kind of thinking coming all the way through to the present day. And in spite of this sort of so-called right-wing populism is essentially an invitation to hand power over to the, as C. Wright Mills used to call them, the power elite once again.
Yeah, it really does. To get in touch with the founders' original, people say, oh, the founders, you know, that welfare clause in the Constitution, they were really talking about welfare.
Well, I love the preamble to the Constitution. I think that's
that's
so rarely hear that.
Yeah, they actually were writing checks to take care of destitute people. They were providing for the welfare of America, and they saw this country as a country that was a community as a whole, a country where we took care of each other, not where we said, "Hey, Charlie, you're on your own." Harvey K., brilliant book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. And others. Harvey, thanks so much for dropping by.
Hope to talk to you soon again. Thank you.
Me too. Keep up the great work. You're a spectacular historian. 17 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud. Paleoanthropology, how we evolved. Zoology studies animals, did you know? Physiology is the stuff that's inside you. Cosmology, the universe and how it fits in. Morphology, organisms and their weirdness. Virology studies all viral diseases. Science rocks, science rocks.
Yep, time for our a geeky science alert for the day. Or maybe for the week, I don't know, but a lot of geeky science, great geeky science news out there that I just, you know, love this stuff. Who knew that the stinking farts controls blood pressure? Yes, that rotten egg smell? That's hydrogen sulfide, actually. H2S is what it is. And they found with mice that the mice who have gas have lower blood pressure. Nobody's exactly sure why. They think that hydrogen sulfide might have something to do with regulating blood pressure. There's an enzyme called CSE that seems to trigger hydrogen sulfide activation in the presence of other enzymes. I'm guessing, and this is where, you know, I'm second-guessing the scientists on this because the research didn't go this far. I'm guessing that it demonstrates the presence of bacteria, and we have co-evolved with bacteria for hundreds of millions of years, and so a healthy gut bacteria means a healthy organism, and thus low blood pressure. But who knows? Here's another one. Warm hands, warm hearts. And then we'll be picking up your calls at 866-303-2270 and covering the rest of the news of the day. But this is just great stuff. I love this. Did you know that holding something warm on a cold day not only warms your heart, but actually warms your heart. This was in a 24 October issue of Science, the publication of the AAAS, and if you're into geeky science, you really need to be a member of the AAAS. It's really worth the money. Anyhow, the October 24 issue of Science learned, they did this experiment where they asked people, they recruited, this was the University of Colorado at Boulder, they recruited 41 undergrad students. And when they walked into the laboratory, they were casually asked to hold a hot or a cold cup of coffee for a moment. Then they were given a brief fictional description of person A and asked to rate 10 personality traits based on the summary. They weren't aware that holding the cup was part of the experiment. But holding the cup changed everything. Those who held hot cups or warm cups were more likely to assign positive traits such as generous, caring, or sociable to this mythological person A than those who held the cold cups. Then they did it. They did the test again. The second experiment of the study was presented as a product evaluation study. At the end of but the same thing, you know, hold the warm cup, hold the cold cup. At the end of the test, as a reward for their participation, they could choose either to reward themselves with a voucher for some free products in the community, or to give the voucher to a friend. Now, again, they didn't realize this was part of the experiment. Among those whose hands had been warmed, 54% decided to give the voucher to a friend. Those who held the cold cup, only 25% decided to give the voucher to a friend. Pretty cool, huh? The French fruit fly fracas, actually, I think we talked about this at the time, that, you know, Sarah Palin going off on the fruit fly studies. Turns out that the fruit fly studies actually were of considerable importance. Palin said that it was, you know, she says, you've heard about some of these pet projects. They really don't make a whole lot of sense. Well, that's because Palin, she says, things like fruit fly research in Paris, France, I kid you not. Well, actually, recent results from studies on other fruit fly species may help scientists understand autism, a disease that Palin had mentioned in the same speech because her nephew has it. And, of course, fruit flies are a huge economic problem in California. Research on fruit flies, important stuff. It's actually important stuff. Hey, they've discovered the origin of bad hair. Ever had a bad hair day? You're excused. Scientists previously, this by Gianna Berners, senior writer for, I don't have the publication here, I think it's probably Science News. Scientists previously had thought hair was just a mammalian thing. Turns out it goes all the way back to reptiles. Humans, birds, and reptiles have a common ancestor that goes back some 300 million years. Turns out that common ancestor of both reptiles and mammals had genes for making keratin proteins. Keratin is the primary protein in hair. These proteins in birds and reptiles, however, were used for claws, not for hair. But it's the same stuff. And actually, I saw, you can see it today on the AAAS website, a new study that goes even beyond this, where they found that that keratin gene may have something to do with the comb on the top of a rooster. So it's very interesting. They say, we think that this common ancestor of reptiles and mammals formed claws and that these claws are made of these keratins, which only later in mammals acquired an additional role in forming hair. Eckert and his colleagues looked for hair keratin genes in the genomes of a chicken and a lizard, mammals' close relatives, and they found a human-like keratin gene in the chicken and six different genes that were, you know, keratin-producing genes, basically, in the lizards. So, number one, well, that's a fascinating fact. Number two, this was 500 million years ago. That's a little before the 6,000 years ago that Sarah Palin thinks the world was created. Somebody needs to have a talk with her. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for our live free video stream. Yes, Mark Begich is ahead in Alaska. Moving ahead. I'll keep you up to date. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call 866-303-2270. Thank you.
people say a man is made out of mud, and other men say that it's a muscle and blood, a muscle and blood, a skin and bone. I got a mind that's weak and a back of that's strong. Give me 16 tons and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. Same Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Welcome back to your radio support group for We the People of the United States of America. This, as they say, from the wire services, confounding the conventional wisdom that he is a lame duck president with no agenda. In his last days in office, President George W. Bush is redoubling his efforts to mutilate the country before his term expires, aides confirmed today. White House spokesperson Dana Perino said President Bush has spent the first 7 years and 10 months of his presidency doing everything in his power to leave the United States in smoldering ruins. He certainly is not going to let the final days of his tenure go to waste. While Ms. Perino said that President Bush is proud to have led the U.S. into, quote, a pointless and totally avoidable catastrophe in Iraq and the most terrifying financial cataclysm since the Great Depression, end quote, he is, quote, in no way prepared to rest on his laurels. Mr. Bush, Ms. Perino said, is delighted that the stock market has lost $1 trillion of its value in the last 3 days and, quote, that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the damage he hopes to wreak in his remaining time in office. Among the targets for destruction that the president is currently eyeing, Ms. Perino indicated that the demise of the big three automakers was at the top of his list. She said, if the president could preside over the disappearance of the big three and the millions of union jobs they represent, that would be the ultimate feather in his cap. For his part, Mr. Bush took few questions from reporters today, saying he had to return to the Oval Office to order random airstrikes over Belgium. Yes, it's tongue-in-cheek. It's Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. A tip of the hat to Andy, and thanks for letting us use his funny material. But, boy, it cuts kind of close to home, doesn't it? 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And hang on just a second here. Let me put a call on hold. And Carrie in Oakland, California. Hey, Carrie, what's up?
Oh, good morning, Tom. Or good afternoon, I guess, from where you are. I'd like to thank you, first of all, for having Dr. John Lott on the show a couple of days ago. I found that refreshing.
John Lott, who is an advocate of pretty much everybody having as many guns as they want, of any kind they want, with no restrictions whatsoever.
Well, you know, that is, if you go back far enough, that was the ultimate leftist thing to do, you know, back in 1775, when General Gage sent his men to Concord and to Lexington to seize all stores of powder and ball from whoever they could find them on. Yeah, that is leftist.
You know, you're right, Kerry, and I'm not sure I call it leftist, but I call it revolutionary. And,
well,
if you believe that the government of the United States is not us, and you don't want to participate in American democracy, and you think that our government is an it or a terrible thing, and you advocate the destruction of our country, I can see where you would have that point of view about today as well.
But not necessarily that. You see, there's actually something about not.
Well, how can you draw a parallel between overthrowing the British occupiers of the United States and suggest that you're not suggesting that you want to overthrow the current government?
No, that's not. I'm not suggesting anything
like
that.
So you like our
that.
Government? The United States?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
What I'm saying,
why do you say that we should have absolutely unrestricted access to guns so that we can throw out the government?
It's not because we can throw out the government. We need.
Well, when we went against Gage, that's what we did.
Let me finish talking here, Tom. We need unrestricted access to firearms for the human right of self-defense. Human right, not just constitutional right, but human right. It goes beyond the Constitution. It digs deeper. It goes further back. We all have a human right to self-defense.
Okay.
Now, I remember that you had a caller pretty much toward the end of the hour in that day after Dr. Lott had gone, after John Lott had, you know, clicked off or whatever. And it was a female caller. And she said, well, statistics prove that they'll just take it from you and use it against you. What a damn dirty lie that was. No, statistics prove exactly and precisely the opposite. 2.5 million times a year. A gun in the hands of a private citizen is used to stop a crime in its tracks or stop a criminal in its tracks one way or another. All right, and since you said you're an NRA member, since you said you're an NRA member, you are, I'm sure, are aware of these statistics, but you just let her
get away with
that lie.
Well, I've read the claims. Certainly, I've read the claims, but I've never seen any kind of reasonable science that would back that up. But let me say, Kerry,
statistics. DOJ.
Okay. All right. Well, let's assume for a moment that it's true. I am all in favor of Americans being able to own pretty much any kind of reasonable firearm, from a handgun to a hunting rifle that they want. I don't think that either one of us want people to be able to buy, for example, a surface-to-air missile.
That's correct.
Are we together
on this? Or machine guns, for instance.
Right. I mean, we can probably argue about it. Maybe not. I don't know. Assault weapons. You know,
well,
anything that can go full automatic, you don't need for a sport. You probably don't need for defense.
Full automatic, no.
Yeah, although I still think that there should be an exemption like there was in Georgia when I lived there. We used to go to a shooting range where you could use a full automatic weapon, but only on the range.
Yeah, and those people always in Massachusetts as well is like that. Those people pay like a multi-$1,000 license fee to go play with their expensive toys.
Right,
it's stupid, you know.
Well, I don't. I really enjoyed putting an Uzi on full automatic and dumping 50 shots into a target. You know, I had a lot of fun doing that. But the point is that I, for example, if a gun is good for self-defense, and I will acknowledge that it is.
Nothing beats it.
Probably not. A small airplane is very good for flying from, you know, one town to another within a couple hundred miles of each other, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'm licensed to fly a small airplane. In order to do that, I had to demonstrate my proficiency with that airplane. I had to learn how to use it, and I had to demonstrate my proficiency. Want to know that if somebody's walking around with a gun in their pocket, that they actually know how to use the thing safely?
It is not the government's purpose or reason to make sure that that person has that proficiency.
So then you don't think we should have driver's licenses?
No, don't spill over into another topic now. I'm saying that
Kerry, the only reason why we have driver's licenses for cars or pilot's licenses for airplanes is because of the damage that can be done by them if they're used improperly. We don't have driver's licenses for go-karts.
So you think we should have licenses for people to own guns? That's fascism, Tom, and you know it.
Fascism is the merging of a corporation with the state, Kerry. That might be totalitarianism.
Brady is a fascist. Sarah Brady is a fascist. Anybody who wants to register
Kerry, let me
your
help
guns,
you strengthen your argument.
Anybody who wants to take your guns from you or even register them is a fascist. Gun registration was invented by Adolf Hitler.
Let me help you strengthen your argument, Kerry. Hitler, the Brown Shirts was a volunteer movement within the Nazi Party, and they were armed, and Hitler wanted them to have guns without regulation.
To take them from people without registration.
No, I'm serious. I mean, go back and read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Scherer.
I did it when I was in seventh grade.
Let me strengthen your argument. You're talking about totalitarianism. Fascism, as Benito Mussolini defined it, is when the state and corporations merge. He dissolved Parliament and replaced it with what was called the Cameo de Fascistio Corporationes, the Chamber of Fascist Corporations. You should call somebody like that if you want to suggest that gun ownership with license is not freedom. You should call them a totalitarian rather than a fascist, because it's more accurate.
Well, here, you know, you're making up your own definitions, because, you know, if you really want to get down to the very bottom end of it, Mussolini was a socialist. His political party was called the Italian Socialist Movement, you know, like Castro. By the way, you can't own a gun in fascist Cuba either. And there's a neck that ought to be stretched.
Wait a minute, I thought Cuba was socialist.
Yeah, well, same thing, Tom.
Okay,
same thing. And by the way,
Kerry, let me get this straight. You're saying that anybody
who wants to take your gun is a fascist. Anybody who wants to spread around lies in order to brainwash you, and you think, oh, they'll just take it away from me anyway, you know, the bad guy in the house, you know, they are evil fascists. like that
what's
woman who called,
Carrie,
like Sarah Brady.
Carrie, what am I missing here? I, you know, yeah, that's fine, and you know, you can do all the name calling you want, but I mean, let's talk about the actual issue here for you know, we've got 60 seconds left before the break. What is it about licensing a gun that's any different than licensing a car? I don't hear you yelling about the DMV. That you want to be able to drive without a car license.
Well, I'm sorry. I don't need a car to exercise my human right of self-defense. You know, I can't carry a car around in my pocket to shoo off some junkie or some vermin that comes up to me. Oh, you got a cigarette? You got a quarter? And then
you seem very frightened.
More, you know? No. Bad analogy.
But a car, don't you have a human right to transportation?
The leftists have to get
freedom
away.
Freedom of movement?
The left has to get away from denying people the human right of firearms ownership. Because once that happens, and I think Bill Clinton did learn this lesson when he lost his Democrat Congress in 1994 over this issue, the left has to stay away from this. Because you'll have a lot.
Carrie, politically, I agree with you. I agree with you. You know, and I lived in Vermont for a decade, and in Vermont,
you can carry with
no permit. You can buy a gun, you can own pretty much anything, and you can carry it, and it works fine for Vermont. But I think, and therefore, I'm a little wary of federal laws. But I also think that if a state or municipality says, you know, in New York City, it's not going to work so well, they ought to be able to have that law.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270, your telephone number, Stephen in Danville, California. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Good. What's up?
I'm calling in part relation to the last caller about the right to drive versus the right to keep and bear arms.
Yeah, let me assert, the First Amendment clearly states that we have the right of free association. Now, the only way that I can associate in this modern day and age with most people political, and the Supreme Court has repeatedly interpreted the First Amendment as applying primarily to political rights. In other words, free speech, for example, it's one of the reasons why a politician can't be prosecuted for lying about another politician. That if I'm going to politically associate with others, I have to be able to transport myself to where they are. And that means that I should have the right to drive without a driver's license.
That's the stretch.
I don't think that's any more of a stretch than suggesting that the Second Amendment says that there should be no laws whatsoever that have to do with licensing guns. Although I do agree with Gary that this should be I don't know if this is his position or not, but my position is that this should be up to the states, not the federal government.
Well, while I agree with you that I don't agree there should be no laws whatsoever, let me suggest that the most recent book I'm reading is called The Origins of the Bill of Rights by Leonard Levy, which, and I might even have gotten this from one of your suggestions, but I'm not sure. But it's an incredible book about the history of where our rights come from. And if you go back in history long enough, there was a time in England when the yeomanry were actually required to bear arms of the type in that day. And that at one point the Protestants in England were not allowed to bear arms while the Catholics were allowed, and that this was one of the things that was remedied in the English Bill of Rights of 1689. So we have a very long tradition, which, you know, comes originally from English common law, thence into American law, and if you read the various versions of this in individual states, bills of rights at the time of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and all that, it is clear that individuals have a right to keep and bear arms for self-defense and to be part of the militia.
Well, that's I was just going to say, Stephen, there's a giant gotcha in that argument. If you go back, and this was actually explicit in the Constitution of Pennsylvania in its early days when it was a Commonwealth, before it folded itself into the United States, before the United States was created. And even, I believe, in the early days of it being a state in the United States. And that is, and Jefferson, among others, was very outspoken about this. They wanted every able-bodied man between the ages of, as I recall, 17 and 45 to own a firearm and have it in their home. They wanted to require it. But the gotcha is that also they did not want there to be any standing army during time of peace.
Correct.
And that's the history of the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment was
a standing army.
Right, exactly. The Second Amendment was originally proposed. Jefferson said, and I wrote about this in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? There's a whole chapter about this. Jefferson said, you know, I am pleased that our people are happy enough, our young men are happy enough that they will not be willing to hire themselves out to be shot at for a sixpence.
Right.
And Madison wrote at length about how standing armies are a pernicious force. Jefferson wrote about it. Even George Washington was an opponent to standing armies during
peacetime. It goes back to that English Bill of Rights from 1689 where they didn't want a standing army.
Right. And so the Second Amendment was not created to say every American citizen should have the ability to grab a gun, to own a gun anytime they want. Although you could derive that from it. The Second Amendment was originally put forward as a way of banning armies, because they were afraid, they had seen the history of so many European countries where the army rose up and took over the government, where you had military coups.
Right.
And like it just happened in Thailand, like happened in the Philippines. Like, I mean, we've seen this just.
Right. But there were also states that said that you have a right to have a weapon for self-defense.
I've never seen that in the Constitution of any state. I can tell you, in Pennsylvania, the Constitution explicitly said that they wanted that there would not be a standing army during time of peace, that every able-bodied man between the ages of 17 and, as I recall, 45 would be, A, a member of the militia, and, B, would be responsible for maintaining their own firearms.
I'm going to respectfully disagree with you. At the time that Pennsylvania made their Constitution, they had no militia within the state at all. It was entirely an individual right. And that's something that is brought up in this book, The Origins of the Bill of Rights by Leonard Levy, who I believe is a law professor.
No, but my point is that it wasn't for self-defense. It was for defense of the state.
It was not entirely for the defense of the state.
Their vision was the way it is in Switzerland right now. Every able-bodied man is a member of the military, and the military doesn't exist unless the country is invaded, at which point every man in the country is the military, which is why Hitler never bothered to invade Switzerland. I mean, who would want to invade a country where every single male in the country has a gun and is the military?
Okay, I agree with you, but at the same time, I believe at the time of ratification we had 14 states, and they were not in uniform accordance with any of the rights that they were according to their citizens.
Well, that's, you know, in that regard to that, Stephen, go back and read Alexander Hamilton's, I believe it's Federalist 54, it might be 74, the one where Alexander Hamilton goes off on how there should not be a Bill of Rights in the Constitution because a Bill of Rights was a royalist.
There were many people who
No. These were not people who the whole point, the argument against a Bill of Rights is that the Constitution should not define rights because, and this was the big debate between Madison and Jefferson, frankly. Madison agreed with Hamilton that there should not be a Bill of Rights because he was afraid that if they put a Bill of Rights in, that future generations would think that the rights of average American citizens were limited to those explicated in the Bill of Rights. And what Hamilton was saying was, no, if we have no Bill of Rights, then everybody understands that the government has no rights. It only has responsibilities and limits.
Tom, can you hold me over to the next segment?
We're out for the day. I'm sorry, Stephen, but you know, call back another time. It's a great conversation. I love it, but we've got to wrap up the show. Coming up tomorrow, it'll be Friday. It's Brunch with Bernie. And Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, will be taking your calls. Plus, our favorite economist, Dr. Ravi Batra, is going to drop by. We'll have a great conversation with him about where the economy is going, where it's been, and how it's going to get there. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.